Well, I thank Walter for organizing the year, and it's like a very exciting program. Also, Peng Fei for inviting me. I've been to the Fields Institute only once before, and it's a beautiful building. It looks like a great setup, so I'm sure it'll be a very successful operation, as it already is. So I'm going to talk about a subject, general relativity, and sort of so just as very, very basic background, I have a slide on Newtonian gravity. So Newtonian gravity mathematically amounts to specifying a mass distribution and then solving the Laplace equation or the Poisson equation for a gravitational potential, and then the force is given as minus the gradient of the potential. So from a geometric point of view, the geometry of Newtonian gravity is the R3 geometry. And if you wanted to think of a space-time, you would take R3 cross a time variable, and there would be an absolute time coordinate. Now, the history of relativity is that around 1900, special relativity was discovered, and the geometry of special relativity is quite different. It's the so-called Lorentz geometry. So in that case, space is R4, the natural space, so time is naturally a part of the space or a coordinate in the space. And the relevant metric is the Lorentz metric, which I've written there as ds squared. And then the basic principle of relativity is that the physical fields are defined in terms of tensor fields, and the evolution equations for the fields have to be Lorentz invariant. So in particular, these are wave-type equations, and so in special relativity, one is solving wave equations in one space and three time variables. A very, very good example of that's the Maxwell equations, which actually were preceded special relativity. And I have a few slides on them, but I think I'm going to skip them because I won't have time to do the remainder of the talk. So the important point to make about the Maxwell equations is that in order to construct electromagnetic fields, one poses a Cauchy problem. So there's initial data, say at time zero, and then the solutions are gotten by evolving the initial data, and it amounts to solving the wave equation. Okay, so then relativity arose in an attempt to make these two theories compatible. Okay, so, and this is the invention of Einstein about 1915, and what Einstein found, or for various reasons, is that you can't expect to model gravity as a field relative to the standard Minkowski spacetime. So in fact, the theory of relativity actually models gravity as a non-flat Lorentz metric. So it's a purely geometric theory. The space-time is, instead of the flat space, is a four-dimensional manifold, and the gravitational field is a Lorentz metric on that manifold. So a Lorentz metric is simply at each point on M, it's a Lorentz inner product in the tangent space. So that means it's an inner product whose signature is minus one minus and three pluses. So what that means is that at each point of the space-time, you can introduce a basis of vectors in which the Lorentz metric looks like the Minkowski metric, minus one, 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 one. But however, as you vary the points, for example, the light cones, the null vectors will vary. So it's really a smoothly varying field of Lorentz inner products, tangent space, and then the Einstein field equations, which are the evolution equations for the gravitational field, then have to be written in purely geometric terms. And what they do is they couple the gravitational field via its curvature. So the left hand side of that equation is the Ricci curvature, which is a symmetric 4x4 matrix associated to G bar. So it depends on G bar and its first two derivatives. And the right-hand side of the equation involves the matter. So T in that equation is the stress energy tensor of whatever matter fields are present. So in general, there's some matter fields, and then gravity is coupled to the matter via the Einstein equations. Now, mainly in this talk, so I'm actually a differential geometer, so I'm going to ignore the matter. So I'm really interested in the gravitational part of this. So a very important special case of the Einstein equations is the case of vacuum spacetimes. Okay, so like electromagnetic waves, which can freely propagate through space, gravity has a similar feature. So in other words, you don't need matter to induce a non-trivial gravitational field. You can have just freely propagating gravitational waves, and those would be solutions of the vacuum Einstein equations. So that's, although a lot of what I say can be extended to more general settings, I'm going to focus really on that case. And you should think of this as being a wave equation. So actually, as we'll see, the Einstein equations really have two components. There's a part which is called the constraint equations, which is an elliptic part, and there's another part which is a wave equation, okay, which is an evolution equation. Yeah, a question? Okay. Go ahead. Mm-hmm. Well, if the right-hand side is zero, then t is zero. So you can, because the right-hand side involved a tensor, it's actually algebraically equivalent to t. So you can recover, if the right-hand side is zero, you can take the trace and prove the trace is zero, and then you can prove t is zero. So. Well, of course, if there are no matter fields there at all, then the non-negativity, right? Yeah, right. If you just I see what you're saying. You could say give me any t and I can construct. I can write down this equation and you know, or I can define t to be the right hand side of that equation, and then I. Oh, which makes Ricci vanish. Okay. Well, in order to construct Lorentz metrics which have vanishing Ricci, you have to solve some kind of Cauchy problem. So you specify, you take an initial hypersurface, you specify the induced metric in the second fundamental form, and then you can evolve a solution. But I don't know of any other way to. I mean, there are some explicit solutions which I'll also describe. But it's like solutions of the homogeneous wave equation. Okay, so I want to discuss the initial value problem for the vacuum Einstein equations. And the initial data for the Einstein equations is posed on a three-dimensional manifold, which will ultimately be a slice, a hypersurface in the space-time. And it has the property that it's a space-like slice. So what that means is that when I take the Lorentz metric and restrict it to the three-dimensional hypersurface, I get a positive definite metric. So that's actually the initial, so GIJ is the initial position for the gravitational field, the induced metric. So it's actually a three metric on M. So it's in other words, you throw away the normal part. So that's the corresponds to the initial position. The initial velocity of the gravitational field is specified by the second fundamental form. So remember, if you have a hypersurface in Euclidean space or in some other manifold, you can define its second fundamental form, and I have the definition there. If I take EI and EJ to be tangential vector fields, tangential basis, then when I differentiate EI with respect to EJ, in general, the result is not tangential. Right? It's only tangential if the hypersurface is flat or doesn't bend in the ambient space. So the failure of that to be tangential is measured by the second fundamental form. So it's sometimes called the extrinsic curvature. It measures how the hypersurface bends in the ambient space, and it plays the role of the first derivative, the first time derivative of the gravitational field. So the initial data is given by it's a second order equation. So the initial data is given by the initial position and the initial velocity. Those are given by the two tensors, G, the induced metric, and K, the second fundamental form. And then you can ask, well, given G and K, can I evolve the spacetime? And the answer to that is, in general, no, because the Einstein equations actually impose constraints. So actually, this occurs in the Maxwell equations also. You cannot specify in the Maxwell equations the electric and the magnetic fields. Generally, there are some constraints that have to be satisfied. In relativity, the constraints are this system of equations. So these become a nonlinear system of equations, which I've labeled VCE for vacuum constraint equations. And these consist of four differential equations, four PDEs for G and K. And the first one is a scalar equation. R of G is the scalar curvature of G, which is the sum of the sectional curvatures of the metric on M, given metric. And then the quantities involving K are measured with respect to G. So the first equation is a nonlinear scalar equation, and the second is actually a system of three equations. So that divergence is actually a vector field. If we could write it out in components, it would look like the equation there in purple. So there are really four constraint equations for G and K. So this set of constraint equations is clearly a very underdetermined set of equations. So there are 12 unknowns. So G is a 3x3 symmetric matrix of functions, and so is K. So there are 12 unknowns, and there are four constraints which must be satisfied. Okay, these constraint equations have to be satisfied in order to have any hope of producing, of these being initial data for the Einstein equation. Let me explain the constraint equations. They're actually something very simple and familiar in geometry. You can see this in your surface theory class. If we just think of flat space, okay, so flat space, of course, is a special Euclidean space is an Einstein manifold, but it's actually more than that. It's flat. So if you take a hypersurface in Rn plus 1, then that has an induced metric and an induced second fundamental form. Now, in general, if you ask the question, given G and K, can I produce a hypersurface for which G is the second G is the metric and K is the second fundamental form? The answer is no. The answer is you can, if and only if a set of constraint equations is satisfied. So these are the familiar Gauss equation, which I've written here, and the Kedazi equations. Okay, so these Gauss and Kedazi equations are the necessary and sufficient conditions on G and K that you can realize them on a hypersurface in Rn plus 1 locally. Okay, and the constraint equations are just a traced version of those. So if the ambient space is Ricci flat instead of flat, you get some you can take some traces and you can produce analogous equations. So those constraint equations just arise from the Gauss and the Kedazi equations for hypersurfaces. Okay, so in order to pose the initial value problem for the Einstein equations, we in general need some boundary conditions. So typically if you try to pose a finite boundary value problem where you specify some boundary conditions on a domain, I think that's not been very thoroughly studied. What people have mostly looked at is the case of a compact initial surface, which is very relevant in cosmology. The one I'm interested in actually is the asymptotically flat case. So this case I think has more structure and is more interesting in many respects. So this from a physical point of view is called an isolated gravitating system. So it corresponds to a finite system of gravitating stuff, you know, matter and gravitational fields, and it assumes everything else is infinitely far away. So if you like, it's the analog of the Newtonian situation of a finite mass distribution. So if you take the potential for a finite mass distribution, then it will satisfy that equation, and it will fall off at infinity, like 1 over r, like 1 over the distance. So similarly, asymptotically flat solutions of the Einstein equations, or asymptotically flat spacetimes, have the property that outside some compact set, they look like Minkowski space, like the flat space. And so the way that can be formulated, I'll be a little rough about it, it means that you can introduce coordinates near infinity so that the exterior of a compact set is R3 minus a ball, and so that the metric components, the GIJ, fall off to the Minkowski or the Euclidean metric delta IJ up to terms which vanish like 1 over the distance. So order 1 over, that turns out to be the right sort of fall off, and that corresponds to the Newtonian fall off, in fact. And the second fundamental form, which involves a derivative of the metric, falls off one order faster, a time derivative. So these are the roughly the natural assumptions on the asymptotic decay for these isolated systems. Okay, and this is the setting in which much of the mathematical work in relativity has been done, and it's also the setting which is very important from a physical point of view. So there are two basic examples to discuss. One is the Schwarzschild metric. This is the mathematical solution of the vacuum Einstein equations, which corresponds to a static black hole. So it's actually a singular solution. It's rotationally symmetric, so it's really the exterior solution that I'm mainly interested in here. It has an explicit form. In fact, there's a theorem of Birkhoff which says that the Schwarzschild solution is the only rotationally symmetric vacuum solution of the Einstein equations, even locally. And so it has that form in spherical coordinates. So T is time, R is a radius, and C is a point on S2. And in particular, a natural initial data for this is the T equals zero slice, which then has zero second fundamental form, and one could think of evolving Schwarzschild metric from that slice. So you can change coordinates and rewrite the induced metric in this conformally flat form on the zero slice, and you can sort of picture that as being so this as R goes to infinity, you're approaching R3, and then you come in, this neck here is the horizon of the Schwarzschild, and the interior stuff is actually behind the horizon, but actually at the T equals zero slice it looks just like the exterior part. So there's another asymptotic component which exists behind the horizon at time t equals zero. So there's a lot of, physicists have analyzed the Schwarzschild metric to death. They compute the geodesics, and a lot of calculations in relativity are based on the Schwarzschild metric. So this is a very important example. Yeah, question?
On your previous slide, you had your space finders study is take out a ball.
Right.
One cup.
Right. Right. Yeah, so the well, it really depends on what you're trying to prove. If you're solving the wave equation, then certainly having two components will necessarily cause singularities in the equation. So if you're hoping to get a nice evolution, you should probably look at smooth initial data with a single component at infinity. However, many of the theorems that deal with initial data work with multiple ends. So you can construct Schwarzschild type examples with three ends or four ends also. Okay, now there's a second solution which is also extremely important, and again, a lot of predictions in relativity are based on it. It's called the Kerr solution, and I won't write it down explicitly because it's somewhat more complicated than the Schwarzschild. But again, it's an explicit solution, which was found much later than Schwarzschild. It was found only in the 60s, the mid 60s, I believe. And it models what's called a rotating black hole. So if the black hole is rotating with some angular velocity, then it's a stationary solution. Then it in fact is the Kerr solution, and it has a mass parameter like the Schwarzschild, but it also has angular momentum J, and in general it's stationary, so it's not surprising that if you fix the mass, the angular momentum can't be too large. If it were spinning too quickly, it would somehow have to not be stationary. It would have to evolve in time, and in fact that is the case. Okay, so actually, from the point of view of the general theory, the importance of the Schwarzschild and Kerr solutions are that they provide models, asymptotic models for general solutions, both at time at spatial infinity. So if you think of a slice and you move out toward r equals infinity, and also conjecturally as time goes to infinity. So there are various conjectures which suggest that if you take fairly general classes of initial data, they should evolve and for in large time settle down to a stationary state. And that stationary state would then have to be a Kerr, or if it had no angular momentum, a Schwarzschild. So they definitely are models at spatial infinity, and assuming various conjectures about the evolution are true, they also give the time asymptotic models. So these are very important from a theoretical point of view as well. Okay, now a very important thing for this talk is that so this is kind of an ugly slide, but the asymptotically flat spacetimes have the feature that near infinity they have approximate symmetry. So they're asymptotic to the Minkowski space, which has a large symmetry group. Now the symmetries at infinity give rise to conserved quantities under the Einstein evolution. Okay, and there actually are energy, which is a conserved quantity, which corresponds to the mass that we discussed before in the Schwarzschild, and P corresponds to linear momentum, J is the angular momentum, and it's defined here in terms of the rotation fields in R3, and then there's also a center of mass that one can define. So there are 10 asymptotic quantities in all. So energy is 1, and then P is 3, J is 3, and the center is 3. So that's 10 total. And these quantities are conserved, although there's some linkage between them, of course, under the flow. But these are quantities which exist asymptotically and are somehow rigid quantities in the theory. Okay, so I said in the Schwarzschild and Kerr, so there are actually various. You can take different slices in Schwarzschild, and you can exchange energy for linear momentum. So in general, the mass is given by the quantity e squared minus norm p squared. J is the angular momentum in the Kerr, and this e p together forms a time-like vector. That's its Lorentz length, which corresponds to the mass. That's called the ADM. Total energy momentum vector. And there's another point I should make. Going back to the previous slide, under the asymptotic conditions I suggested, the angular momentum need not exist. So if you look at this angular momentum expression, the pi there is just algebraically related to k, so it's a quantity that decays like 1 over r squared, and y is the rotation vector field in R3, so it grows linearly in absolute value. So if you took the absolute value of the integrand in that integral for J, you see that it only goes to zero like 1 over R, but you're integrating over a two-sphere of radius R, roughly. So if you took the absolute values here, that integral would definitely diverge. So the existence of that limit depends on certain cancellations which occur in the top-order term. So in particular, in order that angular momentum exists, you need a little stronger fall-off conditions on the metric, and these have been studied. So very natural ones are what are called the Reggie-Teitelboehm conditions. So they require an asymptotic evenness for the induced metric for Gij, and an asymptotic oddness for Kij. So in other words, while Gij itself, the components fall off only like they're Euclidean plus 1 over R, the odd part, that is the difference there, is falls off one order faster. Okay. So you need that kind of condition or something like it in order that the angular momentum integrals be defined, be well defined. And I should say that all these asymptotics can be given a more precise form. Particularly, there's a paper of Krushel where he discusses, you know, more precisely in terms of weighted Sobolev spaces or whatever, what sort of more optimal asymptotics are for which you can define angular momentum. But I'm not going to get into anything technical here, anything more technical than I'm already getting into. Yeah.
So 2 points so far away, how many asymptotics?
Say it again.
Is there a problem having x and minus x be related in such a way?
Well, so you have to consider asymptotically Euclidean coordinate systems. So that condition actually will be independent of coordinates in suitable asymptotic charts. Yeah. So there is always that issue too. No, because the top order term is definitely even. It's delta ij. So. Okay, so let's see. There's a sort of grand conjecture about the evolution, and I just want to put one slide on it. I'm not going to say anything about this, but I want to just give some idea. This conjecture actually isn't quite true, and it's not, you know, it's not also not quite well formulated. But the grand conjecture called cosmic censorship says that so in general, when you solve the Cauchy problem, you can solve it for short time, and you produce a short-time solution, but when you try to find the global evolution, you, in general, will encounter singularities. For example, you expect to have gravitational collapse, black hole-type singularities. Cosmic censorship roughly says that black hole-type singularities are the only types of singularities you can encounter. So what it says is that there should be no naked singularities. So that means there should be no observer in space-time who should be able to see a singularity in its past. Okay, this is sort of the compactified picture of a smooth space-time. So Minkowski space would look like that, this sort of diamond picture. So you should think of this as being conformally compactified. So the points out here are actually at time-like infinity. This is sort of rotated around an axis. So each point corresponds to a two-sphere, actually, in this picture. This would be a picture of a singular space-time. So there's some singularities up here, but in fact, no observer, those singularities are not in the past of any observer in the space-time. So there's a region in green there, one, which is predictable from the initial data, and then there's a region two, which is behind the event horizon, and those guys are sort of lost forever. No escape from the black hole. So there's this sort of grand conjecture. Now, what is actually known is of course, much more modest. So there's a very long paper going back to the mid-80s of Christodoulou and Kleinerman where they study the small data problem. So they look at the vacuum Einstein equations, look at small data near the Minkowski data, and then they prove global existence, and they prove that it settles down actually in that case to a Minkowski space. And I should mention very recently there's a great simplification. That paper is about 500 pages long. There's a dramatic simplification of that work, although the result's a little weaker in terms of the asymptotic. Actually, Kleinerman says it's much weaker, but it gives weaker asymptotics, but it proves the same theorem. It proves that for small data, the evolution exists for all time and produces a complete space-time. That's a recent paper by Lindblad and Rodnyansky, which is about 50 pages, I think. So it's a great simplification in terms of complexity. It also uses a simpler scheme. It uses just harmonic coordinates, which is one of the basic classical ways of trying to solve the fixing the gauge in the in the Einstein equations. So I should say there's a lot of other work where you assume rotational symmetry, not for the vacuum equations, but for various matter fields which exist. And I should mention, in terms of stability questions, there's an important conjecture, which is the stability of the Kerr solutions, which is very much unknown at this point. You ask me a question?
There is,
yeah. That occurs in this part two. There in these. So those are solutions which have external fields, which are these scalar fields, and that's right. So there are some interesting discussions of cosmic censorship in that setting. Right. So some people have modified cosmic censorship to say that for generic data there should be no, yeah, or something like that. Right. It's not completely clear. It's true. I should also mention, I'm running out of time, but another prediction of this grand conjecture, which is called the Penrose inequality, has been verified over the last five or six years. It's an important work by Huskin Ilmanen and Hugh Bray. So that isn't directly related to the evolution equations, but assuming this grand conjecture is true, there's a prediction about the area of a horizon versus the total mass, and that particular inequality for initial data has been proven in many important cases. So there's some evidence for this for the correctness of this conjecture. Now I want to describe in the remaining half hour or so, 20 minutes, 25 minutes, some things that I've been doing with initial data over the past several years along with one of my students. And so I'm going to look at the following question. So there's a question always, this comes up in many contexts, the question of what are reasonable asymptotics to assume for vacuum initial data, say. So the basic problem we're going to discuss, and I'll give various motivation and applications of it, is the question of constructing classes of solutions of the vacuum constraint equation. So these are vacuum initial data for the Einstein equations, which have particularly simple asymptotics. Okay? So in general, the constraint equations are a very weak set of equations. So from those alone, you couldn't expect to prove that the asymptotics are nice. I mean, that would be unreasonable because roughly there are only four equations for 12 unknowns. So in principle, you would expect to be able to arbitrarily specify some number of components and solve for the others. Right? Now nobody knows how to do that in that sort of form. But you at least don't expect those equations to impose strong restrictions on the asymptotic. So I've rewritten the set of the vacuum constraint equations there, and I rephrased the question slightly more precisely. So suppose I had some solution GK of the vacuum constraint equations, which lies in some set. So typically, these are in some Sobolev space with some decay assumptions made. Then the question is, can you find a sequence of solutions with particularly simple asymptotics and which converge to that to the arbitrary solution GK? Okay, and I'm going to discuss two types of asymptotics which arise naturally in this setting and give some applications of these. So there are applications to the global evolution problem. And also there's some applications also to the geometry of the ADM energy momentum vector. And then there's another thing I've done which has to do with introducing angular momentum into solutions of the vacuum constraint equations. Okay, so let me just to put this problem in context, if you were solving the wave equation, you would have some space in which you assume your initial data lie, and that would be a Sobolev space with some type. You might assume some decay. So whatever space you consider, there's a natural dense subset of that space, namely the initial data with compact support. You take smooth data with compact support, and then if you wanted to, I mean, if you prove some estimate or whatever, you could prove it where the initial data is in this special set, so it's smooth with compact support. Okay, so I just want to do something similar for the set of initial data for the Einstein equations. So we'd like to say, given this set of initial data in which we want to solve the Einstein equations, do we have a nice subset which say corresponds to these smooth, compactly supported data? Well, the answer to that is no. Because if we try to look for solutions of the vacuum constraint equations which are trivial near infinity, that would correspond to compact support, they simply don't exist. So if we tried to make G equals Euclidean and K equals zero, which would be the trivial data near infinity, there are no such solutions aside from the standard one. So that follows from the positive energy theorem. So these conserved quantities at infinity are somehow robust. I mean, you can't expect to kill them off. I mean, they're sort of there, in if you impose a reasonable topology on the G and K. So you can't simply look at solutions with compact support. That's not they just don't exist. So the important point is that in order to understand this question, we have to take into account these asymptotic quantities, the energy, the linear, and the angular momentum, and also the center of mass. So I'd like to discuss two types of asymptotics. So actually, one of the asymptotics will be just solutions which are identically Kerr outside a compact set, a Kerr solution. But I'll discuss those later. There's another asymptotic I want to talk about first. So actually, there's an application of this kind of idea, which actually originates in an old paper of mine and Yao going back to about 1980, which actually only deals with the case when k is zero. So when k is zero, the constraint equations simply say that the you're looking at metrics on a three-manifold which have zero scalar curvature. Okay, we were doing the positive energy theorem at that time, and in order to prove the theorem, we needed to assume some special asymptotics on the metric. So of course, you know, we could only do it under these asymptotics, so we got lots of emails, actually before email, lots of letters complaining about the theorem was too special because it didn't include, you know, all kinds of different sorts of asymptotics. So in order to, you know, to calm the people down, we managed to find this sort of density theorem. And in fact, what I'm going to talk about is really an analog of this theorem for the full set of constraint equations. So what we proved actually is that if you consider just zero scalar curvature asymptotically flat metrics on a three-manifold, then you can get a dense subset which consists of metrics which are conformally flat at infinity. So you can't make them flat at infinity, but you can require that they be of the form a function times the flat metric outside some large compact set. And what we proved, and so if you have metrics like that, then the asymptotics are very simple because u is a harmonic function. So it's just of the order 1 plus a constant over r at infinity. So what we proved is that this particular set of metrics is in fact dense in the full set of k equals zero vacuum constraint equations, and the proof is pretty simple. I mean, we just sort of cut off, and then we used a conformal deformation to reimpose the constraint equation, which is r equals zero. Okay, so in particular, that was used in order to generalize to prove the positive energy theorem in sufficient generality. And in fact, actually, that's a typical way in which these sort of density arguments are used. So you can prove something assuming nice asymptotics. You want to say it's true for all solutions of the vacuum constraint equations, so you make a density argument. You prove that the things with nice asymptotics are dense and that the thing you want to prove is continuous in the correct topology. Okay, so that's in fact, a standard sort of application. Okay, so it turns out there's an asymptotic form which is very analogous to the conformally flat form for the k equals zero case, and I've written it here. I've called it harmonic asymptotics. So the asymptotic assumption is that g is conformally flat near infinity, as in the k equals zero case. And this expression pi, which is, remember, is just k minus trace k times g, so it's equivalent to k really. It has the special form, so it's the form LXG. So that's just the symmetrized first derivative of x. So it's xi comma j plus xj comma I, and then minus a trace term. If you have data which has this form near infinity, then it turns out that the vacuum constraint equations imply that these four functions, u, x1, x2, x3, so there are now four functions, those are actually harmonic at infinity to top order. Okay, they're not exactly harmonic like in the k equals zero case, but they're harmonic to top order. So in particular, you can derive good asymptotic forms for u and x. And you can, in fact, isolate in the asymptotic expansions for u and x all of the conserved quantities. You can also find the center, but I haven't indicated that here. So the energy appears in the 1 over r term of u. The linear momentum appears in the 1 over r term of x, and the angular momentum appears in the 1 over r squared term of x. And it's in fact appears as the anti-symmetrized form of that matrix, which appears in those asymptotics. So this data is quite convenient in the sense that in the asymptotics, which are really just asymptotics of harmonic functions, you can read off all of these conserved quantities. So in particular, if you want to somehow control these quantities, this is a very good asymptotic form to consider. Now there are various questions you can ask. Actually, one important feature of the say it again.
In the k equals 0 case
for k equals 0, x is 0, and then you just have the mass. So p and so this would be the mass, right? And so p and x are both 0, so there's nothing below. So that's the simple. That's the previous case. Okay, one feature that these asymptotics have, which actually also generalizes a feature for the k equals 0 case, is that in these asymptotics, if you look at planes at infinity, so if you choose the x3 coordinate to be in the direction of p, which is, so p is a 3 vector, so it determines a particular direction at infinity. If you take two planes which are perpendicular to that direction, and you take them far apart, then the interesting thing is that the region between those planes, if you assume, so the region between those planes is a trapped region. If you assume that the energy momentum vector is space-like. So in particular, the interesting thing is you can sort of see the positive energy theorem at infinity. You can argue that if the energy momentum vector were space-like, which means E is less than magnitude P, then in fact these planes would define a trapped region, and then you could produce a what's called an apparent horizon between those, and then using the equations you can show that no such thing exists. So this is the analog of our original proof of the positive energy theorem in the k equals zero case. So there's a very direct analog of stuff we did in the k equals zero case, which works assuming this asymptotic form for the coordinate. So the interesting thing is that the asymptotic quantities, the energy and the linear momentum, actually determine the asymptotic geometry in a particular way, which can be used to prove the positive energy theorem in this setting. So it gives a new proof of the positive energy theorem. Of course, there's a lot more to say here. I mean, you have to argue that you can actually construct that particular apparent horizon in between, and that it in fact should be an S2. So there's a sort of principle in relativity that apparent horizons are topologically S2s. So we'd be constructing one here that's a plane, an asymptotic plane. So I'm skipping a lot of stuff, but let me just say that it sort of makes a very direct connection with work we had done earlier in the k equals zero case for the positive energy theorem. So in fact, it actually can be used to prove that the energy momentum vector is time-like. And in fact, that's actually a stronger conclusion than our original conclusion. However, later there was a spinner argument for the positive energy theorem given by Witten. And that argument does directly imply the time-like character of the energy momentum vector, but the two arguments have various advantages, different settings. And I should say it can also be, this is the vacuum case, but there's an analogous discussion for matter for this particular theorem. And actually there's a remaining step which was done just recently. In fact, actually this asymptotic form I noticed 5 or 6 years ago, but I wasn't able to prove that the solutions with that form were actually dense. So about a year ago, Corvino and I were actually working on a different asymptotic form. But in the course of that, we also showed that in fact solutions in harmonic asymptotics are dense in natural topologies, in the space of solutions for the vacuum constraint equations, and. So there's just a couple of remarks to make. You can actually, this theorem is true even without the Reggie-Teitelboehm condition. So you can take a set of initial data for which angular momentum is not defined. You can approximate it in this way and approximate it by a set in which the angular momentum is defined, namely the harmonic asymptotics. And then, of course, as you let I go to infinity, the J will blow up or oscillate or something like that. So it's an interesting procedure. In particular, this principle is also used in what I described before. You can actually use the procedure to impose angular momentum in a interesting way. Okay, so let me just say that in the course of that work, in fact, let me describe this theorem that, let me describe this theorem about imposing angular momentum. So if you remember the Kerr solutions, it's true that the angular momentum is constrained by the energy, by the mass, right? And actually people, I mean, it depends on who you talk to. I've given talks about this theorem before physicists, and some of them say, oh, yes, of course, and some of them are surprised by the result. If you remove the stationarities, just consider vacuum solutions of the Einstein equations, then in fact, the angular momentum is unconstrained. So one of the consequences of this, which is actually a fairly subtle theorem, is that you can actually take any solution of the vacuum constraint equations. You can assume it's in harmonic asymptotics if you want to, and you can specify any angular momentum vector and any center. And then you can perturb it near infinity to impose that angular momentum in that center. So it's the physical principle that if you take a very small amount of mass and you start it rotating far away from the axis, then the angular momentum is very big. So that's sort of a very easy principle in classical mechanics. This is a version of that for the vacuum constraint equation. So the energy is gravitational energy, and this theorem says that you can, within vacuum, the set of vacuum solutions, do that kind of thing. So in particular, it says that there is in fact no constraint on the angular momentum, which follows from the Einstein equations. There's no constraint like there is on the linear momentum and the energy, right? So the energy is always bigger than the linear momentum, but the angular momentum is arbitrary, right? With specifying, it can be arbitrarily specified with a given energy and linear momentum. Okay, let me just mention that there's one sort of interesting feature that appears in the existence theorem for the density theorem for the harmonic asymptotic. So this is in the paper with Corvino that I mentioned. Namely, one can define the constraint map, which takes a g and a k or a pi to the constraint, the quantities which are zero, the left-hand side of the constraint equations. So this is a constraint. This is a map that takes pairs of symmetric tensors to a function and a vector field. We call that the constraint map. So the zeros of the constraint map are the solutions of the vacuum constraint equations, if you like. And one of the important technical theorems in the proof of density, which I didn't know how to do before, actually, is the fact that if you take any asymptotically flat solution of the vacuum constraint equations, then phi prime is in fact surjective. Okay, so the density involves some kind of inverse function argument, right? So to get to apply the inverse function theorem, you need the linearized operator to be surjective on appropriate spaces. And the surjectivity of that operator is a bit subtle. In fact, actually, it had been considered before, back in the 70s. It was shown to be true in 77 by Schoke, Bruha, Fisher, and Marsden, but only in the trace k equals zero case. So I haven't said too much about the constraint equations, but in the trace k equals zero case, there's a particular method to solve them, which is due to Lichnerowitz and York, called the conformal method, and so the trace k equals zero case is a much easier case for solving the constraint equations. So in that case, they use the conformal method to prove this theorem, but it actually is true in general. I should say there was also a formal argument given in a paper in 1997 by Baig and Omuraha. So they didn't sort of do the analysis, but they gave a kind of formal argument for that. Now there's a second asymptotic form that I also wanted to discuss, and this is from a physical point of view, the most natural asymptotic form you could ask for is you could ask for initial data which are identically equal to a Schwarzschild or a Kerr at infinity, right? That's actually the relativity analog of compact support, in some sense, right? because you know that you can't really kill off these asymptotic quantities, but you could ask that near spatial infinity the solution be exactly given by one of these. In fact, that was an unsolved question for a very long time. And in his thesis, Corvino in 98 did that for the k equals 0 case. So that corresponds to zero scalar curvature metrics. And he showed that in fact, if you take metrics of zero scalar curvature on R3 or on a 3 manifold, which are asymptotically flat, then in fact you can always approximate them by zero scalar curvature metrics which are exactly Schwarzschild near infinity. So they're exactly of the form 1 plus m over 2r times delta. So that theorem. So that proves the density theorem for the case k equals 0. So these metrics, these space of metrics script S are actually dense in the set of all k equals 0 solutions. And then scalar curvature, right? So it's a scalar, kind of a remarkable theorem. It says that if you took any, the metrics on R3 say a zero scalar curvature on infinite dimensional space of metrics, right? So it says that you can take any metric, assuming just reasonable asymptotics, and you can approximate it by one which is exactly Schwarzschild outside a compact set, and has R equals 0. So you solve the constraint equation. And so it was natural to extend this to the set of the full vacuum constraint equations. And in fact, we did that in the same paper that I referred to earlier. It was also, we were a little slow to write it up, so it was also done around the same time by Crucial and Delay. And it has an interesting corollary. I'll state the theorem on the next slide, but it has an interesting corollary for the evolution. There's a class of space-times which had been discussed a lot by Penrose, which are called asymptotically simple spaces. So those are space-times which are conformally compact. So there's those sort of diamond pictures that people draw are actually rigorous in the asymptotically simple cases. It wasn't known whether there were any asymptotically simple space-times before this theorem. And in fact, there's lots of work by Helmut Friedrich where he constructs asymptotically simple spacetimes, but assuming the initial data are of this special type. So in fact, one of the things that this theorem does is it produces initial data which in fact does evolve to asymptotically simple spaces. So this had an interesting impact on the global evolution problem also, although it wasn't done by us. It was another reason to study this question. Yeah. So you can find small data solutions. So you take small data solutions, then Christodoulou-Kleinerman, for example, showed that it evolves to a non-singular space-time. But Christodoulou-Kleinerman, in fact, conjectured that there are no asymptotically simple space-times. They did a very delicate analysis at time-like infinity, and they found terms which didn't appear to be compatible with the asymptotics. See, if the decay of the initial data at spatial infinity isn't good enough, then the singularity out there propagates to null infinity, right? So you need spatial infinity, you know, really nice behavior. And in particular, these kinds of initial data produce such. So in a certain sense, the asymptotically simple space-times should be thought of as a dense subset of, you know, all reasonable space-times globally.
So the positive mass
Yeah, it's a delicate, right. I mean, you really, when you start looking at asymptotics near time-like infinity, you really get some delicate calculations that come into that. It's not just the mass. It's sort of terms that are higher order in the expansion. Okay, so the statement of this asymptotically Kerr theorem is here. So if I called script K the set of initial data, so they're solutions of the vacuum constraint equations, and they're actually identical with a suitably chosen slicing Kerr. So you have to choose slices for which the energy and the linear momentum match up. So in general, if you take Schwarzschild, if you take the T equals zero slice, that has no linear momentum. But if you boost the slice, then it does have linear momentum and it has less mass, less energy. So there's an interplay between those. So the theorem says that in fact if you take any reasonable solution of the vacuum constraint equations, this has to satisfy the Reggie-Teitelboehm condition, then in fact K is in fact dense in the set of all reasonable solutions of the of the vacuum constraint equation. So there's an approximation theorem which can be done there. And so these kinds of theorems, I mean, in principle, these theorems are very simple. They're really just sort of cutoff theorems, right? I mean, if you want to prove that the smooth, compactly supported functions are dense in a Sobolev space, well, how do you prove it? You just cut off the function, and you prove that as you let the cutoff go to infinity, it converges. Okay, well, that's the basic idea here, too, really. The problem is that if you do the cutoff and you cut it off to some exterior solution, then the problem is that you when you try to reimpose the constraints, you just can't do that. You just can't do that without being very careful about it. But you do it is a kind of matching theorem. So the idea is that you look at the interior solution, which is arbitrary really, and you try to match it to the correct exterior solution. Okay, and it turns out you can do that. So one of the new features about it is that you can actually solve these constraint equations or the linearized the constraint equations with compact support. So you can construct smooth solutions with compact support for these equations. And again that's very much related to the fact that it's very overdetermined. So in particular, these kinds of solutions are very far from being real analytic, but you can make them see infinity. Okay? You can make them as smooth as you like. I think even see infinity, these types of solutions. So it's a kind of matching theorem where you have certain obstructions that you have to meet when you match. The obstructions come from the precisely these conserved quantities, these the energy, the linear and angular momentum, and the setter. So anyway, it's a sort of messy story. I mean, the papers are sort of long, but the ideas are I think relatively relatively simple. So maybe I'll just stop there.